including Cabernet Francs, Sauvignon Blancs, and Beaujolais Village. More information is at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
Nice tune, Don, but can you whistle with your tail like an Anna's hummingbird?
Hummingbirds can whistle with their tails?
Male Anna's hummingbirds, which live along the west coast of North America, can. Scientists in California discovered this when they were studying the bird's courtship behavior. They noticed that certain high-pitched chirps were produced only when males made rapid, swooping courtship dives. The chirps were produced at the bottom of the dive when the birds flick open their tail feathers. One of the scientists discovered that the two outermost feathers of the male hummingbird's tails had an unusual shape. He plucked these two strange feathers from one male and then let him go in front of a decoy female. The plucked male saw the stuffed female and started a courtship display to impress her. He swooped into the dive in front of her, but this time there was no chirp. The curious scientist then attached one of the tail feathers to a long stick and found that if he spun it around fast enough, the feather started to hum. By holding feathers in a wind tunnel, he found that at wind speeds of 44 miles per hour, the modified tail feathers make high-pitched chirps like the ones heard during the flight displays.
Wow, so the tail feathers work like whistles?
Actually, it's more like a clarinet. When you whistle, the tone is produced by air whistling through a constriction. The tail chirp is produced by vibration of the feathers themselves, like the reeds in clarinet mouthpieces.
Neat. Maybe they should change the name from Anna's hummingbird to Benny Goodman's hummingbird.
Oh, Don.
This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Raymond Foundation.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Kenneth Jensen in the Medical Sciences program. For a Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
It's 2:42, and we're having some difficulty here this afternoon. It seems like some heavy weather is headed our way. That's what we think is going on. So occasionally, we are losing our signal. So what we're going to do here is, Jason Croft, our technical director, why don't we put some music on, Jason, and rather than play around with this, and we'll see if the weather cooperates here and what we can be back on the air steadily. Okay, we'll give it a try here now. Let's go to sports. Manuel Beltran is out of the Tour de France after testing positive for EPO. Liquigas team spokesman Paolo Barbieri says the rest of the team will continue in the three-week race. The veteran Spanish rider also has been suspended from the team. If a second backup sample also tests positive for the drug, Beltran will be fired. He confirmed, this is Barbieri, confirmed that French police were searching rooms at the team hotel. And talking to Beltran. There's no change at the top of the overall standings after today's seventh stage of the Tour de France, which was won by Spain's Luis Leon Sanchez. Luxembourg's Kim Kirken leads Cadel Evans of Australia by 6 seconds. And Germany's Stefan Schumacher by 16 headed into tomorrow's 107-mile trek. Let's go back to the CD player, Jason, and we'll see if we can get this fixed up. It's 2:46. Schools often take a hit when the economy suffers. Some states are trying to protect their education budgets from the current economic downturn. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
If you're an educator in a state like Michigan, you probably feel like someone keeps plunging your head into a bucket of ice water. During economic booms, you get to take a breath. But right now, it's time for another dunking. 22 Michigan districts are facing deficits. Don Watruba of the Michigan Association of School Boards says that as operating costs go up, there's only one way to trim: cut staff.
A lot of our younger teachers are the ones that get laid off because they're the lowest on the pay scale as far as the union goes, and then those students leave the state to go work somewhere else. So I think we're having a problem with eating our young a little bit.
The irony is that Michigan legislators this year approved a small increase in per-pupil spending, but it's not enough to keep up with the cost of education. Combine that with the fact that enrollment is declining rapidly in places like Detroit, and you can see why educators are running out of hair to pull out. When it comes to higher ed, the picture is equally bleak. Budget problems led the University of Nevada to axe the all-time favorite instructor of a student named Hepi Mehta. So Mehta held a going-away party for his teacher, complete with a call to action on Facebook.
I just said the budget cuts suck was part of the description of the event. And that actually started getting a lot of reaction.
In the form of student protests against a looming 14% cut in funding. The University of Nevada has already suffered about 7% in cuts over the past year, leading Provost Neil Samatresk to write an angry screed, much of it in all caps, calling the shortfall, quote, a dagger in UNLV's heart. Now, we could go down the list of states like Florida and California facing torture by education cuts, but it's so much more refreshing to hear about states that are trying to protect school budgets, like Pennsylvania, which is raising state funding by as much as 15% in some districts. And despite economic troubles in Arizona, school districts there got a 2% bump in state money. Chuck Essex of the State Association of School Business Officials says that's because voters there passed an initiative in the year 2000.
Which requires the legislature annually to fund operational expenses in schools with a 2% increase or inflation, whichever's less.
But that hasn't protected the Mesa Public Schools, the largest district in the state, from having to consider school closures. Once again, the culprit is declining enrollment. Truth is, educators are often reluctant to admit when they are doing well. Richard Miller of the University of Wyoming clearly does not want to crow about the generous allowance his school is getting thanks to oil and gas revenues.
Oh, on a biennial basis, probably 15%.
In recent years, Wyoming has been using its energy bonus to boost spending both on K-12 and higher ed. Richard Miller says the university is trying to make sure that energy money will keep flowing by training workers for energy fields.
We have an enhanced oil recovery institute that's being funded now. There are clean coal research monies that the state's providing us.
Same deal in Alaska and North Dakota. Educators in these states say while they are benefiting from higher energy prices, they want to avoid boom and bust funding when it comes to education. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's been 20 years since the federal government announced that Chanute Air Force Base would be closing its doors. That cost over 1,000 jobs and decimated Rantoul's population. But the effort to redevelop the land has produced a number of success stories. Katie Patagrossi served as Rantoul's mayor through much of that time. This week, the village's leader for more than 12 years and resident for nearly 50 is leaving the community. She spoke with AM 580's Jeff Bossert.
Although she's returning to her roots in South Georgia, Katie Patagrossi has called Rantoul home since 1960.
You can't serve in the public as I have done for so many years and not feel like you're an integral part of the community, and the community will always be a part of me.
Patagrossi and her family moved to the village when her husband Ernie was stationed at Chanute. She spent 8 years as editor of the Rantoul Press and later wrote 2 books on Rantoul's history. She also served as executive director of the Armed Services YMCA. But Patagrossi says she wanted to make more of a difference in the community, so she ran successfully for village board. She was later appointed mayor when Jack McJilton left office for health reasons. Patagrossi's goals included building a new police station and downtown planning, but they were set aside one day in 1988 when the Base Closure and Realignment Commission announced that Chanute Air Force Base was targeted for closure.
I cleaned off my desk that morning because we had some press people and other people coming in, and I put everything on top of my desk. I put it in a box, and I put it underneath my desk. I didn't get that box out from underneath my desk until sometime in May, and that happened the end of December. So that tells you where your priorities change.
Pata Grossi says efforts to save the base brought some jobs in, boosting the tax base. But that didn't change the minds of the government.
A lot of people use the term panicked, and they felt like that we were afraid of the future. I don't think that was true. I think that we were given 5 years' notice, and we felt that with 5 years' notice, we could survive. But we were angry because our senators and others did studies using the formula that the Base Closure Commission said that they used. Chanute should not have been closed. There were other bases that should have been closed before Chanute.
Pata Grossi says it was about a year before she realized that efforts to save the base had run their course.
We had one committee working to attract industry, the other committee working to stop the closure. We raised money that simply went into a pool, and either committee that needed it used it. And each committee tried not to do anything to harm the efforts of the other committee. If it looked like that they were making headway in saving the base, then there was a lot of concentration on that. But if we were working with somebody like, for instance, United Airlines, then all of our effort went into that, you know, just kind of back and forth. But we didn't miss a heartbeat in trying both things. But after about a year, we gave up on trying to save the base and concentrated strictly on jobs. And that was a horrendous. We could have been so much more successful if the federal government had not been so hard to work with. And as I understand it, they still are.
Pata Grossi says tenants wanting to use the soon-to-be-vacant buildings at the base weren't provided access until after the military moved out. But once it did, she says Rantoul can be proud for how it came through the process. Redevelopment resulted in a municipal airport, many businesses, the Chanute Air Museum, and Lincoln's Challenge Academy, a National Guard-run program for troubled youth.
Psychologically, I think for us old-timers, it's just good to ride by out there and see those blue suits and see those kids marching. And so it's kind of as a reminder of what was when Chanute was here. I thought that there were times when I was in office that it seemed like Rantoul almost spoke with one voice. If we had a company coming in to look us over and put the word out that they were coming in, people were so good to get out and clean up the community and just make it sparkle. This community has always worked as one community, and I hope that that remains, and I hope that they remember that I was a part of that and that I loved it.
This week, Katie and Ernie Pata Grossi are leaving Rantoul for Tifton, Georgia, to be closer to a daughter, son-in-law, and grandkids, as well as three of Katie's sisters. I'm Jeff Bosser, AM 580 News.
Jeff's full interview with Katie Pata Grossi can be found on our website at will.illinois.edu. It only took a year, but what could have been an empty and decaying complex in Urbana is now a training ground for Homeland Security teams. A couple of days in advance of tomorrow's official opening, AM 580's Tom Rogers got an advanced tour of the building that was once the Champaign County Nursing Home with the head of the Illinois Law Enforcement Alarm System.
It began life as the county poor farm. In the midst of the Depression, it became the health care facility we came to know as the county nursing home. And ILEAS Director Jim Page is keeping a piece of that history in an empty corner that was once a patient's room.
In fact, this is kind of interesting. We found in cleaning, where is it? Over here. In cleaning the basement of the old building, we found the original brass plaque.
No kidding.
Dedication plaque from 1937 for the, they had the County Farm Committee, Public Works Committee, and this was done with a Federal Emergency Administration of Public Works, one
the
of those Depression
administration, yeah.
Exactly.
The isolation hospital.
The Isolation Hospital was its official name, and then I think it had over the door, the main door, it was called the Community Hospital of Champaign County, but it was really a TB sanitarium that they that they used.
With Champaign County's blessing, Page's agency came in and remodeled a more recent wing of the old nursing home into offices, classrooms, and a computer center. It now houses the state agency responsible for training police officers and others how to respond to crises. Page says one side benefit of inheriting an old medical facility is evident when you leave the newly remodeled wing.
So we're walking into what used to be the nursing home. You can tell the difference in the sound because there's no carpeting. It's all
right.
This looks like a hospital.
Like a hospital. This is the C wing of the 1971 building. There was an A, B, and C wings. We remodeled the A wing into offices, and the C and the B wings we left alone. And we're cleaning up. As you can tell, we're mopping and cleaning the floors, and we're going to be rehabbing beds. We're getting some funding from Carl to buy mattresses for the beds, and Public Health is helping us out, and we're going to be putting this back the way it was in case of a special needs shelter. We can also do scenario-based training here, like active shooter. It could be a dorm, situation or something like that as well.
This is probably something that a lot of state agencies or even Homeland Security may not have, a whole wing that you can use even as a whole hospital if you need it to.
That's correct. And our looking around as a model for this for us when we went to do it, we couldn't find any.
So while a training exercise may be taking place in the hospital wing, or it may be even housing real patients in a real emergency, back in the older original wing, officers could be acting out live situations.
We're saving that and cleaning that space up and getting ready for scenario type training. Setting up crime scenes, canine searches, SWAT teams, active shooter, that sort of thing. So it's kind of unique to have a facility where you have the classrooms, the high-tech classrooms, adjoined to a place where you can go actually do the training that they're talking about.
Page envisions a statewide training center, like the Illinois Fire Service Institute on the U of I campus nearby. Officers would come in, learn new practices and put them to the test, and spend some food and lodging money in the local area to boot. In fact, since it's such a unique facility, Page wants to spread the word to other Midwest states, and he's got extra office space to lease to other emergency-oriented agencies. A lot of people worried about what would become of a 122,000-square-foot clump of buildings that serve such a narrow purpose as a nursing home. But Page thinks the new Illinois Law Enforcement Alarm System facility is a win for all.